Okay, welcome back, and we're going to spend some time with a man I call America's most heroic citizen, patriot scientist, Clifford Carnicum, whose work with chemtrails, of course, is and will remain world famous for as long as there are people still walking around with at least a modicum of freedom of speech and freedom of thought. And, of course, that would include the fact that they would have to be relatively aluminum and barium free to engage in those practices, because the stuff they're dropping on us is not friendly. Clifford lately has been turning his attention to that most mysterious and ugly disorder, affliction, syndrome. I hesitate to call it a disease because it's very likely not caused by a typical disease organism as we understand and know them. There's something else, something much more sinister and mysterious at work. We're going to be doing another program in maybe about a week or so and bring us up to date from another angle of this bizarre situation called Morgellons. Clifford Carnicum, are you there?
Oh, I sure am, Jeff. Greetings and thanks again very much.
Sure. Oh, of course. Well, thanks for doing everything you do. I don't know how you do it, but I know we would be literally in the dark ages without your work in terms of chemtrails and now what you're doing with Morgellons. You're probing and pushing into areas that I'm sure that various individuals and what we call loosely the government are not happy about. But to hell with them and onward, as they say. So tell us what's new and where we're going.
Yeah, that's right, Jeff. And I wanted to thank you in return also because, you know, as we look through the years, you know, this is a place, speaking with you, where I know that from the very beginning, same thing, that you had no hesitation of confronting the issue and have a willingness to discuss it from the absolute beginning. And I thank you equally in return for providing that platform, and that's why I very much choose to speak with you.
Thank you.
And I value your commentary along the way very much.
Thank you. Well, I'm honored to be able to do it. And there are a lot of very intelligent people out there waiting to hear what you've come up with next. Are the results beginning to cascade now? You've put in the groundwork. What's happening?
You know, I would say that certainly there is an accumulation. I mean, the research is of that form. If the research is consistent, hopefully over time it creates a pattern and a base of information that, mm-hmm. that helps us understand a more comprehensive picture as a whole.
Right.
And hopefully we're making some progress that way. I thought in terms of a rough outline so the audience would have an idea what to expect. I'd briefly give an idea of the layout of the schedule we have us
very good.
Between us and then go on from there. I thought I'd take the first hour and catch up with some papers that they didn't exist when we spoke. I see that we spoke back in November of last year, and we made a reference to several papers that were forthcoming. Mm-hmm. Probably three or four, and we covered
right.
the general intent of those papers very briefly and quickly. Those papers now exist. There's probably three or four of them, and I'd like to sort of summarize those papers to catch up with what we were talking about at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the last hour or so, shift towards two papers of pretty strong substance, I think. That do look at things from a more comprehensive sense, I think, in terms of what we're dealing with. And before we even did that, you know, I thought I would take a second and just, you know, it's nice to reflect sometimes and understand where we are. And I thought I'd take a second and answer the question which I was asking myself is, you know, why did I actually enter into this aspect of the research on Morgellons? You know, how did that happen? And we know that my work started in the aerosol side of things, 1999, beginning of 1999. We're up to 11 years now. And the first reference that I made to an issue which caught my attention on this was back in 2003
mm-hmm.
on my side. And then the actual first paper I wrote relative to the Morgellons issue was back in 2006. So, you know, we're already talking 5 to 6 year period.
Wow.
Out of that 11-year period
mm-hmm.
where there was something about this issue that let's say, was worthy of our attention some time ago. And what it was, I think there's two main parts of it that caught my attention. And the first was the way that the issue was handled in the public arena. Namely, that you had an issue where something serious was happening in the same way that you had, the physical reality, direct observation and thousands and thousands of people getting involved on the aerosol side, meaning the environment was changing. Now you had a health issue where, again, you had like people with physical things going on,
mm-hmm.
and they were reporting this, and the issue is ridiculed and denied. And the similarity of pattern is that in the aerosol issue, everybody is told, everything is just normal. Don't worry about anything. When the Morgellons issue arises on the scene,
right.
They can't exactly say it's normal because it's highly abnormal what was being reported. So they introduce the term delusional, right? They characterize people as being crazy. So on one side, they're saying, everything's normal, everything's fine. In the other side, the strategies and tactics of marginalization and ridicule are the same in both cases.
We might
now
also
they need to call the people delusional.
Yeah, that's called DOP. We might want to mention also, Clifford, for our tens, if not hundreds of thousands of veterans out there who have very serious psychological, neurological, and physical problems who are being given the same delusional diagnosis by the VA, which is an outrage by any measure.
And when you're dealing with something that is physical, all right, it's a little bit risky to take in that tactic, but, under the programming side of propaganda and programming, we're at the stage where you can basically put in any agenda you want out there, and that's the one that was chosen. The other reason that I was drawn into this issue was because of the similarity in physical form from the very beginning. In other words, in the aerosol issue, you had the appearance of a very, very unusual filament structure, really just about from the onset, and it's
sure.
The EPA gets involved.
Right.
And then in the Morgellons issue, you have the same type of form going on. You have an unusual filament that no one is willing to acknowledge or address properly, and yet physically you have it. So, these were the two reasons, I think, that I saw, let's call it, some level of association between these situations and
sure.
why they were deserving and worthy. And, as I look back, we have 5 to 6 years, and the overlap, as we've gone along, actually has become stronger and stronger more, I think, than people even realize. So with that being said, in terms of the underlying connection in terms of the way the issue was handled in the public, let's go on into these papers that we talked about last time, where we spoke of the issue, but
sure.
the papers weren't written. And there's three or four papers. One of them is called A Mechanism of Blood Damage. One of them is called, it's about pH and conductivity, and I want to focus on the live analysis part of it. And another one is on animal blood, and another is on what I'm calling an environmental source. And, I said I might not have time for this environmental source paper, but, truthfully, that paper really deserves to be talked about. So I'm going to do my best to give a highlight at least on each of these, and maybe some I'll get through very quickly, and I think we'll have plenty of time.
Okay, very good.
To finish them.
But, by the way, Clifford's latest offering is up at rents.com as well, right below his name and guests. It's called Morgellons, A Discovery and a Proposal.
Yes, thank you, Jeff. The first paper that I'd like to bring up is this paper called A Mechanism of Blood Damage. Oh, and you know what? Before we do this, as I was saying in your notes, why don't I outline the physical nature of what I'm finding over and over and over and over, year after year now?
Please do, because that kind of consistency is bedrock to a lot of people who may be open-minded but unsure, and that's crucial.
Yeah, and then, as we go along here tonight, I'll keep referring to these things, and I think it can get a bit confusing. I mean, I have a pretty intimate, let's say, acquaintance and knowledge with these things, and it gets a little tricky, I'm thinking, from the outside to envision them. But before we go into these papers, there are four, call them structures, call them entities, call them potential organisms, whatever you want to call them, but four things that are being found.
All right, very good. Stand by right there, Clifford, if you would.
Yeah.
We'll come right back and name those four things as we set the stage for our conversation tonight with Clifford Carnicom, one of the truly great Americans of our time. Be right back. Okay, let's get right back to Clifford Carnicom. All right, Clifford, please, let's lay out those four items of groundwork on the table and proceed.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. With respect to the Morgellons condition, there are four structures or entities that I am identifying over and over and over from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There may be others, but this is what I have access to with the equipment that I can see.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with the filament. This is the obvious one that caught people's attention to begin with, and, you know, this became present on the skin.
Also known as fiber.
Yes. And this particular structure at this level is visible to the eye. And with what I'm seeing right now in the culturing work, which we'll talk about later, at this point, this represents the culmination of the development stage that I can see. I see probably four stages of this also altogether. And the filament is the culminating structure from the best I can see. Now, the size of this is roughly, generally, seems on the order of 12 to 20 microns. This is something that can be seen by eye. Human hair is roughly 60 to 100 microns. So you can pick this up by eye. And then inside of this filament, and I'm still regarding this as just one structure right now, but inside of this you can have a sub-micron filament structure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great deal of similarity there with the airborne environmental samples that got tied in with the EPA, and that was my reference to the similarity in form at the beginning that caught my attention. So this is one, a bounding or an encasing filament, which encases frequently or often a submicron filament network. Number two and three are both what I would call in the bacterial-like. I need to and continue to use the word phrase like, because we don't have the absolute positive identification that we need. But in terms of what these appear to be closest to in terms of form and life, assuming it is a regular living organism, is of the bacterial class. And so I call them bacterial-like. And there are two of these. One of them is circular in form. Roughly, best I can come up with is a, roughly a half a micron in diameter, somewhere in there, anywhere from 0.5 to 0.8 tenths of a micron.
Mm-hmm.
Not normally accessible with, you know, visible light microscopy. We've talked about that in the past, but, you know, I'm up to about 10,000 max, and I can pick these things up at that level. You would probably just see it at about 5,000. But it's beyond the limit of conventional microscopy. So if we have to think about the normal world getting access to this information, it's not going to happen without access to electron microscopes or somebody that's in the right world or high-quality digital equipment, that type of thing, but certainly not conventional microscopy. So the first is this bacterial form, which I call chlamydia-like. This is the best I can come up with in terms of its characteristics, size, and its life cycle, this type of thing, and specifically chlamydia pneumonia. And I'm not saying it is chlamydia pneumonia. In fact, if you read my papers, as we'll talk about later tonight, it doesn't fit entirely. But it's the closest that I can come up with. The third is what I call pleomorphic form. Again, the strongest candidate here in terms of what it seems to match most closely in our world that we're familiar with is mycoplasma. Mycoplasma by itself is too small. They're about 0.2 of a micron from one another. They're apparently the smallest bacteria that there is without a cell wall. And in fact, because they don't have a cell wall, that's what allows them to assume different forms. And this is where the word pleomorphic comes from.
Right.
And so what I'm seeing, I believe, is a growth basically of that organism, which manifests. And if you look at the colony forms of mycoplasma, you will see it match, again, as close as I can to anything I can find. Several pictures. It's the best I can come up with.
Two-tenths of a micron.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Two-tenths of a micron puts us down, just for our listeners, into the area of viruses.
That's right. It's right in that transition zone. And so I can't actually, I've had a hint of it, actually. I can tell there's something there, but I just don't have the resolution to pick it up. But the later growth of it, of a mycoplasma colony, is something that's visible. They actually, you know, they can become visible by eye eventually. So this would be the third one. And those, number two and three, both of those are bacterial-like. And then the last one, I can use the word erythrocytic is what I'm using. Again, we don't know exactly, but let's just say it has a match across in all ways, size, shape, you know, biconcavity, to an erythrocyte or a red blood cell. The part that gets very strange about it is there are some tests that indicate a very strong likelihood of an artificially developed erythrocyte because of some very perfect geometry that showed up within a set of tests, as well as an increase in size in one certain test, almost like the conditions of reconstitution were absolutely ideal, and they came to be even a little bit larger in size.
So what you're saying is that these what appear to be red blood cells are almost too perfect to have just, they don't look natural, they're too perfect, and some of them look like an erythrocyte on steroids. They're huge.
I have a whole paper. Again, we just sort of run out of time and topics, but I have a whole paper. The title of it is called Artificial Blood with a question mark after it. There's a whole paper in depth that shows that whole reconstitution process, their association with the filaments and this type of thing. Remember that this filament, that bounding filament that I'm speaking of, eventually is encasing all of these structures that I'm talking about. So, you know, if we wanted a single package where all of these things are, the encasing filament would have it. But yes, that paper is rather remarkable to me in terms of what it shows. It indicates a very strong likelihood that, you know, that was an artificial development or something.
Wow. So as we go to break here, the filament itself may be partially a carrier mechanism. This is wild. Quite a gift basket from hell. Each and every one of them, perhaps. This is quite startling. Be right back with Clifford in just a few minutes. Okay, welcome back. Clifford Carnicom is my guest tonight, and we're looking over his shoulder at some of his extraordinary scientific research into Morgellons, and we've already touched upon the interesting associative value and nature between Morgellons and its symptoms and the aerosol poisoning, which we've been all suffering from for, 15 years now anyway. Go ahead, Clifford, please.
Yes, thanks a lot, Jeff. And, you know, please feel free to ask any questions. And if I don't cover something properly, please interrupt me and make sure we do, because, you know, this whole show is for the audience. And so if we don't communicate what we need, then help me out. But
will do.
We have these four structures that are identified, and the next thing I would mention is that there appears to be a logical, I wouldn't call it logical necessarily, but a progression at least, certainly a sequential progression of growth through those four stages. And if there is a progression to be identified, the best that I can establish at this point would be that the two bacterial forms, bacterial-like forms again, or let's call it, they would appear to be let's say, at the ground floor equally at the beginning. It seems as though these set the stage for further growth and that they are the first to appear. And, you know, I'm introducing the topic of culturing. We'll do that some more as we go along. But this is how this has been learned, is to watch the growth of these forms and how they progress, and they do eventually culminate in that filament form. So the progression I see are the bacterial-like forms on pretty much equal footing, it appears, at the beginning stages. The that middle stage, which hasn't actually been seen to form yet. It's only been seen after it forms, coming out of the out of the filament. You know, that's not exactly true, because we do have some environmental samples that show it, or erythrocytes showing up from the very beginning. But in terms of trying to attach this to the structure, it certainly appears as though the erythrocytes are generally, and that's the same for the bacteria. You can have exceptions outside of the filament, but generally these things are encased or housed within the filament.
Let me ask you a question, please, Clifford. Now, the filament or fibers, which we've all talked about for many, many years, are you suggesting that you have observed and documented that the bacterial-like agent, a circular agent, which you are using the term, what are you using
the
term?
Bacterial-like, you mean?
Yeah, that one. What does it look like most closely?
There's two types. One, the best match I can make is to chlamydia pneumonia, the most close, you know, closest match, again.
So it's a chlamydia pneumonia, that's what I would say. It's not.
Yeah, there's a sexual form of chlamydia.
Okay.
And then there's a chlamydia pneumonia, and chlamydia pneumonia is rather fascinating.
Okay.
Start looking into the symptoms of that and the life cycle of that. It's quite fascinating.
Okay, I wanted to make that differentiation. Thank you for that. Now, are we suggesting that the chlamydia pneumonia and the other forms, including the erythrocyte or the erythrocytic form, and the mycoplasma form, are all housed commonly, perhaps, within these fibers, and that they have been observed by you after you have sectioned or opened a fiber at any point in your research?
Yeah, this is not a suggestion. this is a pile of observations we have.
So you have seen these things come out of fibers in your work?
Yeah, I can see them inside of it.
I've seen the pictures. I'm doing this for the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. No, yes, this is what has been documented in a very painstaking way, is this progression over a period of years. You know, the individual components were seen individually. You know, that first EPA filament, I saw that circular structure. We can go way back to 2001. I have that, you know, submicron structure showing up, you know, and I start saying, hey, there's something here.
I remember.
But as we go along, yes, there's a comprehensive package here that has developed.
All right.
And I regard the filament as a housing or an encasing or a transport structure.
Now, one quick note, and I'm going to step out of the way. The filaments have been observed to move. Now, that would suggest that either the filament itself is capable of motion, some kind of sensory reaction to something, or the agents within it are causing it to move somehow. This is a very interesting and fascinating can of worms you've opened up here.
Yeah, there's plenty of worms, that's for sure. I mean, what I have done is I have recorded the growth of it under time-lapse photography.
Right.
I don't actually have access to, let's say, a continuous source of filaments. I just don't have that. This is only manifest in certain people. So I don't have that record. What I have done is direct my work towards being able to reproduce this in a culture in a controlled environment.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've done is film the growth of it, you know, that exterior casing. But yes, the progression to me is the bacterial-like forms, two of them, the third being an erythrocytic form, and the fourth being the encasing or housing structure. And that housing structure or an encasing filament, that thing is not easy to get into. That, you know, most people, I think that they view that filament as being the sort of the entity itself, but I view it just simply as a housing for what's going on inside.
Mm-hmm.
That material is very hard to get through. It appears to be of a proteinaceous nature, a keratin class, something like this, and very difficult to get into. And about, I don't know, whether it was a year and a half ago or so, a year ago, I found a way of breaking down that filament and basically revealing the internal components through the process, through the use of lye and heat. And if you look into the biochemistry books on basically how to break down a protein, that's exactly what you do. I discovered it after the fact. I found it by, let's call it accident or however we want to say it. And after I'd done it, I had read in some biochemistry books, how would you go about breaking down a protein if you wanted to? And it's exactly what I did.
Most amazing.
It's subjecting it to strong alkalis and heat. And this was the method by which those filaments were opened up. When the this is the method by which the erythrocytic forms were seen emerging essentially from the filament. There's a picture that shows a filament basically broken down, and you see the erythrocytic structures coming right out of the end of it.
Now, how close to the normal human erythrocyte are these erythrocytic structures?
In general, it's a perfect match. What happened here? Here's the variation. In its primary form, it appears to be of what I would call a desiccated nature. From the beginning, environmental samples and such, they were found. They were not the size of 6 to 8 microns as a human erythrocyte is. They were more in the order of 3 to 4 microns in their primary form.
Mm-hmm.
There, it was discovered that a process of reconstitution allows them to, let's call it, restore themselves to their full size. And there's different ways that that has been accomplished. The simplest would be that of a mildly saline solution. These things have been subjected to, you know, these filaments have been subjected to extreme heat and extreme cold, and nothing seems to destroy that.
Well, that would see that we have a break here, but that would, of course, go hand in hand with what we call mad cow disease. The protein form there is also heat resistant, up to, I think, 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. So proteins are not easy to cut into at all, and Clifford's wizardry in getting into one is amazing, only exceeded by the astonishing things that are inside, apparently. These are the filaments. Be right back. I want to point out again, during all the years that Dr. Patricia Doyle and I have been covering mad cow disease and prions, the prions can withstand, and they are proteins, temperatures of at least 1,200 degrees, and Clifford has described a very expected and normal situation with respect to the protein-like substance of the fibers, which appear to be carriers or vessels. For what reason, I have no idea, and we don't know, but we're trying to find out, to bring at least three other primary items into the afflicted body: the erythrocytic object, the chlamydia pneumonia-like object, and the mycoplasma-like object. This is very strange, very, very strange. Go ahead, please, Clifford.
Yeah, Jeff, to answer your question, you know, do they match, human blood cells? Well, all I can say is, to the best that I can do, yes, the reconstituted form of these erythrocytes match as close as anything that you can do, down to the, sub a half micron level or something like that, I would suppose.
Right. Well.
4 to 6 is, or 6 to 8 is exactly what they measure to be. In addition to that, I mean, I have photographs of a human cell right next to it as a control. And, you know, a person can judge for themselves, but see a duck, quack a duck. I mean, it's there best you can tell.
Right.
Now, there's another whole set of studies that were done. I spent months on that in terms of this question of blood. Is it blood? There's a whole set of tests where, I got to the level of, actually, there were three methods, two forensic tests, three total, though, but two forensic level tests that identify hemoglobin within these. It's as far as I can go in making a match.
That's pretty darn scary.
Okay. Yes, the question is there a match? The best I can come up with from the absolute beginning, there has been. Now, as we go along tonight, it gets even a little bit crazier, and it's where sort of a couple of these latter papers have come from, of trying to get a bigger picture of what's actually happened here. And we'll get to that later tonight. But I suppose in terms of, where we go from here, I wanted to give people a sense of, these are like four things. It's over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And for us to be, focusing on just the filament and saying, this is what we should be concerned about, I don't believe that's the case. We need to be looking at what is happening internal to this filament, because that is where the variation is occurring.
Or focusing on the filament and its appearance in the skin and lesions therein, and not understanding the quite logical conclusion that these filaments, fibers, have penetrated the entire organism and are simply manifesting themselves at the epidermal layer for whatever reason, we don't know, but they are certainly not exclusively found in the epidermis. We know that as well.
Absolutely the case. The skin is an excretory organ. It is what gets rid of things, waste products. And what is happening at the skin, again, to me, is a surface representation of what is going on here. And in terms of if people have a sense of these four things, you know, someday I'm going to have to make a page in where I just show these four things together in one page. They are all over the site, scores and scores of times.
Right.
But I probably don't have a single page where they're all shown in one place. I'm not sure that we'd have to look. I'm sure it's probably there as we dig into it. But what I wanted to mention then, if we have a sense of these four, my work increasingly over the last couple years or so has increasingly focused on the bacterial-like forms.
Mm-hmm.
The smallest entities, those that are hardest to sort of get a handle on, they have been my focus. And the reason is this, and it came about largely through the culture observations that I made. But these appear to be the genesis to me. This is the origination of this entity appears to me to be in these bacterial-like forms. And so this is where I have placed my attention increasingly over time. It is difficult to do this work because, first of all, you can't even see these things without having a scope, you know, at the 5 to 10K level, which, you know, we're just not going to have at the common level.
Right.
But increasingly it's been important to me to go after that, and so that's what I've done. Now, in terms of these two or three papers, which whether we make them through it or not, as used, I don't know, but at least we'll summarize it. One of these was called A Mechanism of Blood Damage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you were talking about not just the skin, well, this is a great example. That bacterial-like form and even the pleomorphic form I'm talking about, they are found in the blood over and over and over, thus far, across the vast majority of the population that has been tested. Again, it's only a sample, but statistically, it says we've got a problem, a big problem.
Right.
Because this is showing up in the blood at a very high level on the statistical side. The truth is I haven't found an exception, an entire exception yet. But these bacteria-like forms are in the blood commonly. And it's actually pretty astounding and shocking at sometimes when you see how much is in there, when you actually can really see this.
Wow.
But it's in the blood. Now, there's a paper called Mechanism of Blood Damage.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some photographs of people, you know, that page is on the front page index there. And at some point, I'm not necessarily saying we should go over them tonight, but at some time, I would hope that people would look at these photographs because there was a discovery in this. When I hooked up a new camera, here's what happened in general. These things were seen in the blood, and we know the blood was damaged from it. But we had no idea how that happened. You know, where did that damage come from? How did these things get in the blood? With the camera that I was able to hook up here later, for the first time, you could basically see at least the mechanics of how this happened. And the answer is that these structures are in the surrounding plasma all the time, it looks like, and a lot of them, the number of them can be shocking, you know, circulating in the surrounding fluid of the blood cells and the plasma. And because of the difference in the camera, just that slight difference in quality, I was able to see these structures external to the cells. First of all, remember, these things are measuring about a half a micron, so they're very small. But you saw these things basically congregate around the wall and the membrane of the cell. It's almost, one could say, that they appear to be attracted to it. In other words, these photographs will show you that this bacterial form, the early stage, first it's in the plasma, second stage is that it sort of encircles the red blood cell and attaches itself to the wall, and then succeeding stages are that it starts to break down the wall and enter into the well and enter into the wall. And then the next stage would be the wall is completely broken up by basically a ring of these structures. So like the one I'm looking at here, there's probably 10 to 15 of these on the exterior of the wall. The wall has been broken down. Mm-hmm. And then in the extreme cases, the erythrocyte is completely riddled, let's say, on the interior of the cell with these structures. So for the first time, we could see how it was occurring. And it has to do with, to me, an attachment to the exterior of the cell wall, an attempt to break down that wall and upon success eventually destroy the integrity of that cell. It's really disastrous at that level at this point. And one of the defining stages here that I see in terms of effect on health appears to be whether or not it's able to get into those walls and break them down a lot. It does appear as though the structures themselves are freely within the plasma at all times, even if the blood cells look fine. And a normal blood test doesn't appear to me that it would be showing these things at all. And a person could have a blood cell examination and they could say, hey, it looks just fine. Because until you're getting down to the half micron level, direct observation, I don't know how you'd even pick it up. So that's what happens to these. And so, you know, I regard that as one of the, let's say, critical indicators as to the degree of damage that's done here as to whether or not that blood cell has been broken down, whether that wall has been broken down or not. That's one paper. Another paper shows a live video, basically a live analysis of this, and that is what is that? That paper. It's a long title, but the paper ends with the word "live analysis." It's actually called pH conductivity ions and live analysis.
Right. You can see all these right on the homepage at carnicom.com. Just click on Clifford's name, or just remember CARNICOM carnicom.com. All the papers are right there. Go ahead.
And that live analysis page is rather fascinating because it captures on video, really at the same level. I think I have that. Yeah, I have that at the same thing, 10,000 on those. And it's really quite amazing because here are what you learn in video is you learn that these bacterial-like forms, they are motile, okay? They move, okay? And you can see them move in this video. I'm looking at this now, and, you know, you'll see one. It actually appears to be inside the cell, but as I've looked at this, these cells are really quite transparent at this magnification, and it can actually even be underneath a cell and look like it's in it. But you can freely see these things moving in the plasma around the cell, and it's really quite remarkable because, you know, if someone starts to ask, hey, you know, is something alive here? Well, there's motion, I'll say that. It would certainly, you know, my focus on this has been biology. You know, we've had a lot of folks talk about robots and this type of thing, and maybe so, but I go by direct observation, and I see things of what I would call engineered forms of life, and we'll get to that a little bit more later on. But there's dead serious biology going on here as far as I can see, and I'm not going to say that it doesn't have some level of you know, artificial mechanization at some point, but let's just say I don't have any direct observation of it, and there's enough here to keep us busy without getting into speculative robotic things without
right.
the proof of it.
Coming up on a break here in just a few minutes, talking with Clifford Carnicom about his research into Morgellons and some of the astonishing things he has found. The overall suggestion here is that this appears to be potentially within the realm of human creation, given an evil and psychopathic enough brain and enough laboratory equipment and expertise. But we'll get to conclusions later on. This is a very, very big story. And we're very honored to have Clifford with us tonight. Back in just a few minutes. All right, welcome back. Already a fascinating conversation with Clifford Carnicom, probing and pushing into the mystery called Morgellons, as are others, and he has found some remarkable things upon which to continue to build research and make new discoveries. Again, if this is a human-engineered issue, I just am amazed at how evil the mind and the intelligence must be behind it. Clifford, I don't have any idea what this kind of a project could be for, would be used for, no idea at all, but it's damned evil, whatever it is. Go ahead, please. You there, Clifford? Well, we may have lost him for a moment there. Let's hang on and find out. Let's see here. There he is. Please call back. My phone got disconnected. So, network, please call him back. Not a surprise. These things happen more often than not. Okay, in the meantime, let me remind you to go to Clifford Carnicom's site. Just click on his name. It's C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, carnicom.com. There is so much information there. And the homepage, of course, has that classic montage of six photos showing a relatively blue sky turn into a relatively ugly, hazy, overcast day. The progression, of course, of chemtrails over Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1999. These things, I guess, started around 95, 96. So we're looking at 15 years plus and then some. Are you there, Clifford?
I sure am, Jeff.
Okay, welcome back.
Yeah. That was my side, Jeff. It wasn't a spook. That was my generator had a little quirk in it here.
Well, you at least have a generator. A lot of people don't, so
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, so.
All right. What I was saying was we don't know ultimately if this is man-made or not, but it's beginning to look like this syndrome, this Morgellons issue, this fiber, this filament full of goodies could be humanly conceived and constructed. And if it is, I was postulating and wondering, just pondering, what kind of an evil, brilliant mind would be behind such? It's an extraordinary thing, because people who have this issue are living lives of great misery, and many have checked out. They don't want to deal with it anymore. So just on that basis alone, we have dead people, not to mention the fact that we've had no real 100% up front, above board, absolutely clinically, forensically correct autopsies done on any Morgellons victims that I know of yet to date. But please continue, Clifford.
Yes, thank you, Jeff. And we will be talking about that question within the realm of human possibility as we go along tonight. Two more papers to get through briefly then. One is the title is called Animal Blood. And, you know, there's many obvious questions that should have been answered here. It's just a question of, you know, who's going to do the work. But, you know, certainly one of them that comes across from the very beginning as we start seeing what's going on with the blood is this only human blood that's being affected? And, you know, you would think that question would be answered 100 times over and every species in the planet would have been checked by now if there was any kind of systematic approach to this problem.
You would think.
But, yeah, but to my knowledge, it had never been done. I actually just never had the opportunity. You know, I don't have a pet now, and I don't want to be abusive, and I just never actually had the opportunity to get a source of animal blood until recently, till about, I don't know when this one was, probably about 2 months ago or 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. But I did have an opportunity to receive some legitimate controlled samples of canine or dog blood. And I had actually... put in that request a month ahead of time, and the folks finally were able to oblige me in January of this year. And so I had two dogs and their blood. And one of the dogs is 11 years old. I know that. And the other dog, the age was unknown. But I put this blood under the scope. And the question was, am I seeing these same structures that I'm talking about? This chlamydia-like. And the answer is yes. It's that simple. The photographs are there, very clear. Mm-hmm. Both dogs, one of them, the older dog, appears to be, more affected by it than the other. But exactly the same pattern that I had just described with human blood of encircling the erythrocyte and starting to break down the wall. So this now says, all right, folks, now we're not just talking about humans. And the obvious question is, to what extent does the condition lie, right? And what species are affected or afflicted and this type of thing? Is it mammals? Okay, only, there are so many questions. But to my knowledge, this had never been answered. And now that says it's not anything exclusive to this, and right. Actually gets a little bit crazier than that. It's only very preliminary work. We made a brief reference to it on our last show, but there's some work that I've done at a very preliminary level involving food stuff, mainly fruit, and DNA samples from fruit as well as human, and all I can say is the initial samples showed the same kind of structure going on in the fruit.
I don't like what I'm hearing.
The DNA. We're at the point now where contamination, actually, the level we're looking at is getting to be refined to the point where contamination actually becomes an issue now, where the lab grade work will need to be done very, very carefully and under the controls to determine any kind of species distinction and or different life forms.
What you're saying then is the potential universality of the spread of these items is such now that it's not going to be easy to come up with uncontaminated cultures and other media to do lab work with.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. You know, what I can document here without any question is that the canine blood has been affected. So yeah.
All right. Well, it shouldn't be like you have the time, but let's get hamster blood, mouse blood, rat blood. Let's do mammals, and then let's go into the reptiles, and let's go into the fish, and let's look at some of the other species.
That's right. And then at some point, you're actually going to be looking at the food chain.
I think we already are, in a sense.
Yeah. So that's another paper that's out there. Again, these were all done in January, December and January, right after we talked.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one harps back to this EPA situation, Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, your good friends who so many years ago did their job and analyzed that sample for you.
Yeah, or it didn't, as the case may be.
Did
right?
not, and were rather rude about it, to put it mildly.
So, you know, it's taken 10 years to get to this point, but the method of breaking down this filament is relatively recent. That's only been the last year or so. Through the combination of an alkali, namely lye and sodium hydroxide, and heat. It was learned that the filament structure can be broken down, and the internal components can be revealed. So this environmental sample, back to 1999, which was sent certified mail to the EPA, that same sample has actually been in custody all this 11 years. There's not a lot of it, but it's been in custody. And so after this was discovered about access to the filament through this chemical and thermal means, I did run a test. And the question was, well, what if we were to subject this environmental filament to this same chemical and thermal process? What would happen? And so I did that. And this paper is called An Environmental Source. And, you know, I have to say, you know, we're jaded by now. You know, we just are. But if you actually look at the content of what this paper is saying, it's rather astounding, because what it leads to is that not only do we have the reports about what we're seeing and its structures and all this kind of thing, but we actually even have a source for this. And to me, this has sort of been the most, let's call it missed recognition of basically importance, but it's because we have, you know, look what people have had to deal with for so long, and the lack of response. You know, we're at the point now where you can tell us anything, and it's like, well, we know we've been screwed. You know, so your people lose their their incentive, and it's
sure they give it up. Yep,
it's sort of sad, but you know, we know in the end we can't do that. So what was done here was, I subjected to that EPA filament to the sodium hydroxide and the heat, and then I cultured it. And, you know, the culture thing is a whole different story. I have four different main mediums that have been used. They started out with an agar culture solid. Then it went to red wine, and then it has gone to a white wine, which we'll talk more about. And then I also have a simulated wine. Well, this filament structure, after it was broken down through this means, was placed in the culture medium that had been successful over and over and over with growing the dental sample, same type of filament structure, and culture was attempted. And the question is, what happened?
All right, let's hang on and find out what happened in just a couple minutes, if we can. Clifford, have to take a break. Come right back. Again, just staggering information when you think about it. There's much more to this to come, and through the efforts of people like Clifford Carnicom and Jan Smith and a few others who are really working hard on this, we'll get answers. Will we get answers in time? Is there time? Or is it too late. All right, back with Clifford, hearing things that some of us probably would rather not hear. All right, go ahead, Clifford, please.
Thank you, Jeff. The title of this paper is called An Environmental Source, and it was written in December 14th of last year. Very short paper, but it describes the fact that a culture was made with this environmental source filament, the very filament, the very same material that was sent to the EPA and refused for identification by them. What happened here is that the same growth occurred with the environmental filament as have been grown over and over from biologically based filaments extracted from dental samples. Absolutely identical. You know, I'm amazed here as I look at these photographs. Three of the four structures that we are speaking of are here. The only one that's not there is the erythrocytic form. As a matter of fact, the original, even the original EPA filament was photographed. That'll trace back to the very first photographs I did with a toy microscope on those. They're about a, 100 power or something like that. But the same structures are there. The chlamydia-like structure, the pleomorphic like structure, the encasing filament, and one is about at 300 in the petri dish, so you can see the filaments that are forming. So, I mean, what are you saying here? To me, this was just completely overlooked. But you're saying that you've now identified a potential environmental source for the very things that we're speaking of affecting the biological kingdom on a large scale. What do you need?
Yeah, right.
Right? What do you need?
A large scale, maybe an overwhelming scale, maybe a scale that is going to change life on this planet permanently.
So certainly we might understand EPA's reluctance to, do their work for the public welfare on this.
Right, right.
But one of these photographs as I'm looking at this is amazing. And if anybody ever gets to this and you see it's the one that's called the pleomorphic, but the description says pleomorphic, and it's about in the center on the left side. Just, take a look at that photograph, and then take a look at the cultures that we're going to be talking about as we go on here tonight. And just look at the exact match of form between that photograph from the external environmental filament and a culture from that compared to the biological culture. And you cannot get anything more identical. Now, with all of that being covered, the time we have left tonight, I'd try to split up, and I probably should keep the first one shorter than the latter, but split it up between two papers that have been written within the last 2 weeks. One of them, the first, is called Morgellons, A New Classification, and the latter is called Morgellons, A Discovery and a Proposal, which was finished, what's today? Is today the 22nd?
22nd today, 23rd tomorrow.
Yeah, it was finished today. So I'll try to watch your time here and cover this one, the new classification, and probably need to leave at least 20 minutes for that second one. But this paper called Morgellons, A New Classification, what was this about? And, I suppose it's one of those times of realization, that we have. And what happened here was you just sat back and you sort of digest what we're talking about tonight. And the question that sort of comes up here is, what is this thing? What is this thing in terms of a life form? Because you have, 11 years and 5 years or 6 years directly mm-hmm. where everybody is still at the stage of saying, what is this? And they're calling it a fungus and not a fact fungus, and then they'll come up with a name, and then they say, that doesn't exactly work.
Right.
And it's like nobody can name this thing after, 6 years. You got to be kidding, okay? There's absolutely no reason in the world that if there was something that could be identified, that it wouldn't be identified by now.
Right, correct.
And And we know this on an intuitive level, but we keep trying to look for someone telling us, oh, it's this. And, you know, down the road, somebody will tell you what it is. But right now, we just don't know. There's no excuse for that whatsoever. I have put up those photographs for years, and I've said, this appears to be similar to a certain bacterial type. Tell me if I'm wrong or right. The same pattern for years. The work could have been done. And you simply have to accept at some point that the work has not been done. The work is not being done, and there's no indication the work is going to be done at this point, at the level of directness that is needed.
Think of all the university facilities perfectly capable of jumping into this, folks, and ask yourself, how can it be that not one professor, PhD, is not actively involved in this, who hasn't picked this up and wants to run with it? Not one that we know of.
You know, and at some point, you realize it makes no sense. So how do we make sense of it if no one will help us? And so here's what happened. I just sit back, and I look at these four forms that we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And then we start looking at the structure of life. You know, we can go to any biology book, in my case, a microbiology book. But we start looking at the structure of life, at the taxonomy, as it's been defined. And we start to ask the question, okay, if no one else is going to tell us, let's learn for ourselves, how could this thing fit? And what happens is, I go through each one of these. And you start with a filament, okay? And you say, okay, well, what makes the most sense? And then you step through the next one. You say, what makes the most sense? And you go through the next one. You say, what makes the most sense?
Mm-hmm. That's called Holmesian deductive reasoning.
Yeah.
Hold on, Clifford. I'm sorry. We have to pause. And we'll hold it right there and come right back. Yeah. Just logical deductive thought. When all else fails, use logic. We'll be right back. Okay, gang, a half an hour to go already. These programs with Clifford are just amazing. I hope all of you listen 2-3 times because there's that much important material here. And again, we'll continue to cover this story. I think we're going to be covering it forever, as long as we're on the air, and hopefully people after us will continue until we find out exactly what it is and who did it. All right, Clifford.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. I'm aware of the time, so thanks a lot on that. So I'll probably cut this one shorter, but that's all right. We'll do the best we can with it. Take about 10 minutes. In 1978, you had a person by the name of Carl Woese. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. It's W-O-E-S-E. I'm going to use Woese. But you had a person who basically restructured life. It was a mate in terms of the taxonomy, the structure of life was redefined in a way that made sense. And has been eventually accepted at a pretty broad level. And what happened before was you had these kingdoms. They call them the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom and the fungus kingdom and this type of thing. And when Woese came along, he said, you know, this, things aren't really making sense. And, of course, I'm sure there's always questions. Everything has imperfections. But he took a big picture view of life, and he reorganized it. And he said, you know, these kingdoms, this thing isn't really working. But here's what seems to work better. And he reorganized basically all of life into three domains. He uses the word domain rather than kingdom. And so basically there's a simplification that's taking place, and there's also a new type of hierarchy that's been established in terms of that taxonomy beneath these domains. And the three domains that he establishes are the bacteria, the eukarya, and the archaea. I hope I pronounced that middle one right, or the last one right, archaea. But these are three domains of life, and let me give you examples of what's in these three. We have a sense for what bacteria are about. This is one. The eukarya, it's big. It includes fungus, it includes animals, it includes plants, it includes protozoa, okay? Most of the things that we're familiar with, say, in the living world, other than bacteria, are in this eukarya, including us. So, you know, you have removed that plant and that animal kingdom separation. and they fall under a single domain. And, of course, there are criteria that determine these three domains, but the criteria are consistent, and they're available. I'm not going to go through them in the book, but they have to do with the type of cell wall, and actually what it came down to primarily was the RNA. It was the genetics of these organisms that established this basis for division. And then the last one, or the middle one here, is our archaea. And this is a very interesting group because this is more recent knowledge to us. But, you know, when we hear those stories about these life forms that live in the volcanic vents, you know, and underneath the sea, and, you know, extremely high temperatures, completely inhospitable conditions, these are the archaea. These are organisms that can live, you know, off of methane and carbon dioxide in extreme heat.
Got it.
In extreme cold. That is mm-hmm. a whole domain mm-hmm. by itself. Mm-hmm. In other words, it is of equal status to mm-hmm. most everything we know about mm-hmm. plants and equal in status to the bacteria. And the archaea are considered to be the sort of the oldest form of life on Earth, most likely.
And they could be doing quite nicely on Mars, for example.
Yes, that's right. In fact, this is if you look for what kind of life they're looking for on other planets, it's mm-hmm. most likely the archaea. So if you take this three-domain system, which has now been pretty widely accepted, it's in the standard books nowadays, and then you look at what we have here, I start stepping through these things. And you start with a filament, and you say, okay, maybe we don't know exactly, but what's most reasonable? What is it most like? And you're drawn to the fungal side of things, which is under the eukarya side. And then you start looking at these bacterial-like things, and they are bacterial-like, and you say, okay, they seem like they could be there, but you know there's this problem, and that is that these things are extremely resistant to heat and chemistry, basically. Extreme hostility and hostile and adverse conditions, they hold up, and they not only hold up, they thrive. So there's something that's not making sense there because that form is a little bit more like the archaea, okay? But then by the same token, they have a metabolism that is similar to what chlamydia pneumonia would be like. They live in the cell. They feed off the cell. They have the symptoms of chlamydia pneumonia. So you step through these three of the four, and you're already having this huge split in consistency between existence at the domain level, at the highest level of knowledge of life. You start having these major contradictions and split. And then you get to the erythrocytic form, and it's like, this is nuts. Because, you know, this is not even close to being anything mm-hmm. in the bacterial world.
Right.
Not anything even close to being in the archaea
right.
world. It requires a high-level sophistication, you know,
sure.
mammalian types support system.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're back to the eukarya with this. And so, you know, to shorten this up in terms of what the net effect of this, when I look at this, I say, this structure that we're talking about, it is crossing all three lines of these domains.
Mm-hmm.
It is sharing the attributes mm-hmm. of the three, literally that top level of life as it is known, these structures are sharing them across the board. And so you have to ask, how could this be?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I hope that I'm proven wrong in this paper. And believe me, it's wide open. If somebody can prove me wrong, please do so.
Right.
But the logical interpretation and conclusion here is that you have an entity, an organism, whatever you want to call it, that has basically been engineered. This is a perfect demonstration of the height of, call it creativity,
mm-hmm.
as well as indulgence, in the arena of genetic engineering.
And arrogance.
To seek out the highest levels of life that one could, and to see whether or not it would be possible to create an organism
mm-hmm.
that would cross these lines. and is it feasible? Is it feasible in your imagination that it could be done? it's very feasible in my imagination that it can be done, because you know darn well that's the quest that's going on in genome and genetic work, is to cross any line you can possibly get across.
Oh, they've been at that for years, you bet. Yep.
And so this is my conclusion, that the most likely thing that we're actually dealing with, it truly is a new organism. This is why it's not being identified. It doesn't exist.
Was it designed to reside in living forms such as we know them, or was it designed for something else and it got loose? These are questions that are very important and have no obvious answer for. Somebody on the planet put this together. That's a statement, and it is a possibility. It doesn't rule out any extra help, but this is an amazing thing we're hearing from Clifford tonight, and we'll hear more in our final segment already in just a few minutes. Join you and our guest, Clifford Carnicom. All right, my friend, we just have about 9 minutes left. Go ahead, please.
I see it coming. Thanks, Jeff. I think at some point we may have to simply accept the reality that it's not very likely your local health department is going to come and tell you what's happening. And so at some point...
Never happened, my friend, never.
Yeah, at some point you got to put a stake in it yourself and see what you can do. And this last paper, it's called A Discovery and a Proposal. It's put up today. It's a culmination of many months of work, is what it is. My caveats about medical advice are all over the place, so I'm not going to read them. I'm not a doctor. I'm not giving anyone any medical advice ever. And, please don't call me. I'm asking for anything regarding treatment or anything like that. It's not going to happen. But I will give information freely, entirely freely, with regard to any research that I can do. And that will be done. And that has been done here. And the issue is this. I have probably worked now with hundreds of cultures over the last few months. There's a lot of work that goes on there that we simply are not going to be detailing here. And it's a very slow and sort of trial by error and a lot of different things that work there when you're working with these cultures to combine creativity as well as patience and persistence, I guess, and disappointment and whatever along the way. But obviously the need is to control the growth of this thing, and that means both on the plus side as well as on the negative side. Can the growth of this particular organism be regulated? And can we put a stop to it? We know we would like the answer to this. And I'm saying right up front, there's nothing easy about this, and I'm not going to be coming out with any magic elixir or anything here. I can put this stuff in sodium hydroxide solid lye and heat it up, and it'll sit for three months, and I can take a single drop out of it and start another culture, and it'll start fresh as new every time. So this stuff is not being killed, quote, killed in any conventional sense by anything that I have seen. When you start looking at that discussion we just had on the domains, and you start looking at antibiotic effectiveness, it doesn't look promising to me there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows where that's going to lead, but this is not an easy game we're in, and I'm sure that's not accidental that that's the case. But what I have been working on over the last several months is to see whether or not one can gain any level of control over the growth of this organism, quote, unquote, and possibly any means of suppressing or hindering that growth. Again, we'll be rushed, but I'll try to give 2 or 3 minutes on each side of that equation, and I hope that people will read the paper to see what's happening here and what I'm stating. I think it will be seen that I'm not a person that acts in a mode of despair. I don't care what's going on here. We know what needs to be done, and let's get to it. And I'm doing the best that I can, but a whole lot of work and help is needed. But we have learned a couple of things over these last few months. And One of them has to do with increasing or enhancing the growth. And again, it can get a little bit technical, but I'll try and boil it down to the essentials here. And there are many, many trials that were reached to get to this particular combination or combinations that we're speaking of here. But with respect to enhanced growth, the filament will grow in just about any kind of wine that looks like red wine and or white wine. And it'll grow slowly. It depends on temperature, it looks like, but you can have a range of several weeks, even months involved to getting through the filament stage. And so the typical thing is that you'll see those early stages. Remember, we don't know those four stages. It's the bacterial-like forms that are of most interest to me because these show up first.
Mm-hmm.
Those bacterial-like forms, you can see those within, say, a week or so in these wine cultures. That's roughly that type of thing, maybe a week or two. Every time you have a cycle like that, whether it's a week or 2 weeks or 6 months, then that takes time. And we don't have years. So at least, you know, I've been doing what I can. At that rate, it's going to take us years to make any progress. And that's been the case for a lot. I've been working on this for some time. Well, call it accident, call it luck, call it intuition, call it whatever you want. But there is a particular combination of things that appear to rapidly enhance the growth of this organism. And the basis of it would be a wine culture, so you can start looking into the chemistry of that and learn what's going on there. But then there were a couple things that were added. One is I've been working on the question of iron quite a bit, whether or not there is an involvement with iron, in the use of iron in the metabolism. So iron sulfate was added into that culture. And, you know, that has some interesting effects, but it wasn't dramatic, but it's still a part of the research that I'm doing. There was the additional introduction of hydrogen peroxide, just a couple of drops, in combination with that iron, in combination with the culture, in combination with the wine, and a rather dramatic reaction does take place. The growth explodes very, very quickly at the bacterial-like stage. I'm at the point now where within probably 2 hours I can produce that bacterial-like growth.
Really?
Repeatedly. Without any doubt, the same forms that we're talking about under the microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And so a huge advantage in terms of the turnaround time, that's one. I've also switched over to white wines that are working clear solutions because that's also been a hindrance here in terms of seeing. So now we can see better, we being me, I suppose. I can see better, and it's just basically a lot easier, and it's more controlled than it was. All right. You have this rapid expansion of growth that takes place. The question that comes up is why and how? What is going on? Now, again, it'll be a summary statement, but there's a very interesting chemical reaction that's known. It goes back to 1894. It's called Fenton's reaction, and it has to do with peroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and iron alone. Forget the culture right now. Just look at the reaction called Fenton's reaction. And you'll see that the combination of the iron ion and hydrogen peroxide will produce what is called a hydroxyl radical. Now, what can be said? There's a statement on there. You know, what's the deal? Let's see. Here's a statement. I'll get it on the record, and then we can dissect it over the next few months.
Okay.
The statement is this. Given that a hydroxyl-free radical exists within an acidic environment with sufficient nutrients, the growth of the Morgellons bacterial-like organisms, that's in italics, in that same medium will increase rapidly in the presence of oxidizers. That's a heck of a loaded statement. It took months to get to that.
Uh-huh.
But if you take your time and start dissecting that statement as to what it means, it says that we have some knowledge, it appears, about the chemical and biological conditions that are supportive and enhance the growth of this organism, quote unquote.
So an oxidative environment is encouraging for the growth of these organisms, or
yes,
whatever.
Yes, and the acidic part is a big part of it too. Wine is actually
acidic,
quite acidic.
So acidic, oxidative, and you have the perfect medium so far, as we know.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I know that you know a lot on the health issue, so you'll probably pick this up right away, Jeff. But in terms of the essentials, that's it. The acidic environment appears as though the presence of the hydroxyl radical is extremely favorable, and in the addition of oxidizers in general. Highly favorable to growth. You basically have an explosion that can take place. At the bacterial-like stage, remember, there are stages of this growth, and you cannot generalize to say that what you're talking about, the bacterial-like, is the same as what you would be dealing at the filament stage. But my work, again, is at the bacterial-like stage because that is the genesis of the structure from what I can see.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first half of this paper, of which we could talk about four pages on it, but we simply won't have the time. But at least it gets it out there in terms of, hey, we know something that looks like it enhances the growth of this. Now, on the flip side, the obvious thing that we want to know immediately, I know we're all clamoring for, but it's not easy because I can tell you, you can put this stuff in bleach directly and you can heat it up and whatever you want. It's not going to die. It may be dormant, but you're not killing it. But on the flip side, is there anything we can do that might suppress it?
Mm-hmm.
Many, many, many things have been tried. The old, you know, adage of somebody beating their head against the wall is there, and it's going to be there for us. But cutting to something which appears to be a potential benefit to us, just as, and again, it's simply by pure logic, but if you have something which it grows well in an acidic, oxidative environment, might it not be beneficial if the environment becomes more alkaline? And might it not be beneficial if antioxidants were introduced into the medium? This is the logic of the question, and there is no final answer, but that approach has been pursued at the initial stages, and with particular interest in the hydroxyl radical, which by the way, is like one of the most reactive things in the world. It's right after fluorine. It's amazing. This thing wants to react with anything that it can get its hands on. Because of that proposition, one would now begin to investigate, search for, and look for what are called hydroxyl scavengers. Okay. This is what you would look for. I've done my search on that, at least at the early stages. I have identified three of them that are candidates for my trials and works right now. The first is as ascorbate, or ascorbate, vitamin C, basically. The second is glycerol, the same thing. And the third is what they call an ester salt. There's a fascinating patent. I have applied these in certain trials, and all I will say at this point is that there appear to be some encouraging results regarding the suppression of that extreme growth with the use of these antioxidants. And this paper focuses on questioning and evaluating the influence of alkalization of your diet and your life and the use of antioxidants.
Very good. Clifford, stunning presentation as always. Thank you for all the work you do for all of us. And I mean that, and I'll be here the next time you're ready.
Thanks a whole lot, Jeff, for everything always. Appreciate it.
Indeed. Take care. All right, Clifford Carnicom. He's a remarkable man. I think a lot of you learned a great deal tonight, especially those of you who are very much interested in the issue of what we call Morgellons, but it's so much more than that. All right, we'll be back in 21 hours. See you then.